Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And this is going to be a very juicy, hot show. We're going to be talking about sex and talking about Zen Buddhism at the same time. Can you imagine that? We're putting them both together. The Zen of hot sex, of actually sinful sex even. And to help us do that, we have the author of a wonderful book. I just finished reading it. I loved it. It's so full of great realization and excitement and lots of life to it. It's called Sex, Sin, and Zen. Sex, Sin, and Zen. And the author is here in the studio, Brad Warner. Hi, Brad. Welcome.
Hello. How are you doing? Yeah, I wanted to call it's farther away.
Yeah,
I wanted to call the book "Sin, Sex, and Zen" because that's easier to pronounce. But there you go.
Well, it's you cover it all in the context of Zen Buddhism. Now that is, to most people, that totally screws up their heads.
Yeah,
because what you know, a lot of people don't know what Buddhism really is, or even what Zen Buddhism is on top of that. And how can that have anything to do with sex or not sex? If anything, you know, it's Buddhism is supposedly very spiritual, and if you're spiritual, you should be into celibacy, and you should really not be talking about sex or dealing with it, at least not talking about it in a way that's open to it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's true. You hear the word. People talk about Buddhism a lot these days. It's a big buzzword, and you always meet people who are saying they're Buddhists because they read some book, maybe one of mine, you know, and then they figure they're Buddhist. But a lot of people don't really know what it means, and sex actually is a Buddhism is a supposedly holistic approach to all of life, so sex is definitely part of that. And the earliest Buddhist monks, and I include male and female in the term monks, were celibate. But there was a whole other, much larger realm, even in the beginning, of people who were Buddhists, but not monastic living monks. And there was no rule of celibacy for them. In fact, the idea of sexuality was very open, I think. I always have trouble remembering these. There were only four conditions, and they were kind of male-centric, but you could kind of rewrite them for females that you were supposed to meet. You can't have sex with a woman who is still living under the care of her parents, meaning underage, who is a criminal, who is married to someone else, and I forget what the fourth one was, but anyway, there were, and that was it. So the rules were quite open, but there's this precept that we take which says do not misuse sexuality, and it's up to each individual to try to understand what that means.
Now that's a real key here.
Yeah.
Because the book gets into all aspects of sexuality and holds it in this context of who are we with it and what do we make out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have chapters on porn, on sadomasochism,
a little bit in there, yeah.
and prostitution and strip shows, and I mean, there's so much that you address in ways that many people have many different opinions about.
Mm-hmm, for sure, yeah.
And your opinion is very unusual because you're coming at it from you're a Zen Buddhist teacher.
Yeah.
And a writer, and so this is a unique look, and I love the understandings that you create from seeing it from your vantage point.
Well, yeah, I've kind of been thrown into a world where I have kind of a very unusual view of sex, I suppose. Well, I started writing in 2006 for a website called Suicide Girls, which is, you know, they don't like to call it a porn website, but it's a website full of pictures of naked girls. And what else do you call one of those? But they're very artsy and stuff, and they try to be bring a little class to it, you know, so it's not pure sex. But they, being in this realm and being, you know, associated with these people, gave me an in to this whole world of how sex was being viewed these days, which I'd kind of been a little bit apart from, because I'd lived in Japan for a long time, and they have another completely odd view of sexuality.
They're more open.
Yeah, in many ways they're much more open, and in some ways they're much more closed. But what the upshot of that is, you get to see that there's a whole other way of viewing sex. You've kind of been, not you, but you know, all of us have kind of been steeped in our own culture, and we have a way of viewing sex that we think is universal or just the human or just normal. And then for me, getting going to Japan and seeing this completely other way to view things that I took for granted was a real eye-opener. So yeah, there's a, you know, as far as some of the seedier aspects of sexuality that I cover in the book, I thought it was important to go there and not just assume everybody's monogamous, heterosexual, you know, so-called normal sex, because we live in a society that's becoming very, very open to a lot of different ways of sexuality. It's not just being open to homosexuality and bisexuality. There's a whole you know, universe of sexuality that we're now being confronted with. You know, the internet has really sparked that. There's a story I kind of tell in the book that is sort of trivial but also sort of telling. When I was I was born in 1964, so when I was a kid in the 70s and the early 80s, it was a big deal to get your hands on a piece of pornography. And I have a 20-year-old nephew, and for him, all of his, you know, life as a sexually awakened person, all he had to do was go to his dad's computer and type porn, and then he'd have, you know, a world of porn. And so that creates a whole different way of viewing sexuality when you have so much of this available, and we have to find a way to deal with that.
And that's why, one of the reasons why this book is so important, because it creates context around it. And I like the fact that you've tackled these crazier aspects of sexuality, mm-hmm. and have climbed into it to know people. There's this one woman you interview in the book, and she actually grew up in a Zen monastery.
Yeah.
And she became a porn star.
That's right, yeah.
So the two of you could speak the same language, mm-hmm. and it was beautiful to see. And so she was approaching being a porn star for 20-some-odd years from a Zen Buddhist approach.
Yeah, which I thought was interesting, because she, like me, like a lot of Buddhists, most Buddhists, I suppose, took that same vow not to misuse sexuality. It's part of a set of vows that you take when you become either ordained as a monk, as I did, or you become a lay Buddhist, an official lay Buddhist. And which, if you lay Buddhists, then you...
but
sorry,
no,
couldn't resist that one.
I know, that's cool. But it's actually, you don't say that you're going to not... Do you say actually you're not going to misuse sex, or just not misuse people?
Well, the actual vow is usually given as I will refrain from misusing sexuality. So that's the way it's usually given in English. So in, for example, in Nina Hartley, the porn star that you mentioned, in her case, she has a very she takes very seriously the idea of not misusing sexuality, but of course her business is having sex with people on film or in video. So how do you find a way not to misuse sexuality when you're constantly having sex with strangers? That's what she talks about in the book. And I'm not sure I am 100% on board with everything she says, but it works for her, and actually that's also an important point to make. There's not some universal, you know, this is bad and this is good and do this and do that, the way a lot of religions present sex. In Buddhism, in very ancient Buddhism, there were these really, really specific rules for what monks could and couldn't do sexually, which was basically they couldn't have any sex, but it's spelled out in these bizarre details, like you can't have sex with an iguana, you can't put your thing in an elephant's trunk, and all this crazy stuff is written. But as far as lay people, non-monks, you could do pretty much whatever you wanted as long as you exercise care and I hate the word mindfulness and awareness and being careful with and serious.
Well, that's where we can come from, but there's an industry out there of mm-hmm. sex.
Yeah.
And yesterday I was talking with my wife and a good friend of ours, both females, that right away started to condemn the sex industry mm-hmm. and anything to do with it is exploitation yep. and is hurting people. And so how do you climb into that?
Well, it's a really tough thing because I've taken a lot of heat from people just for writing for the Suicide Girls website, and this is before the book even came out. Just the fact that I was associating with the so-called sex industry and the exploitation. In the case of Suicide Girls, I investigated it and before I started working for them, and I felt that they were handling things pretty above board, and they were, you know, every business has a few skeletons in its closet, but they seem to be pretty good. But as far as the whole industry as a whole, of course, it's terrible. You know, it's really horrible. And to me, the important thing, though, to do about that is you're not going to make it go away. It's here, and it's barring the total end of collapse of Western civilization, the sex industry is not going to go away. So what we need to do instead is to find ways to move it in a more positive direction, which I really feel that in the last few years it has cleaned up a lot, which isn't to say that there isn't a long, long, long way to go, but it's gotten much better. So I feel like it's important to encourage even these little incremental changes that happen to make it better, to make it more fair for women, to make sure people are paid, you know, and et cetera, and testing and all this stuff. I, you know, on the other hand, I do say this in the book, I wouldn't recommend a career in the sex industry. If somebody came to me and said, should I get a career there? And you know, it wouldn't be my first recommendation. But when talking to somebody, for example, Nina Hartley, who's already in the sex industry, well, she seems to be trying to find ways to make it better. And I have to support her in that work. I think it's important work.
So what do we say to people who have a lot of sexual desire mm-hmm. and wanting to pursue, for instance, porn mm-hmm. on the internet? Now, you know, and do they go to make sure they go to the proper websites that they know are treating people well? I mean, what is their responsibility?
That's a really hard one to say because you know, I feel like, you know, on the one hand, you can be very idealistic about it and say, well, if you even look at this exploitative website, you're somehow supporting it. And I can understand that argument, but I feel like the support you offer to it by just clicking on it is so minimal, it doesn't really have that much effect. I think it is important to know what you're spending your money on, for example, if you're going to do that. But I mean, it's such a cesspool out there that it's hard to say anything cut and dried about it. I do think you need to be to try to support the stuff that you feel is doing a good job and not support the stuff that you feel is exploitative. But how you do that, that's a whole other.
All right,
realm.
So let's come back to let's come back to personal. Your own personal needs and use of sexual behavior in your life, how you work with others in relationship yeah. and all that. What is our responsibility? I mean, there are people who really like S&M
yeah.
and all kinds of kinky things.
Sure.
And then there are people who are into polyamory, many partners. And there are orgies.
Yeah.
I mean, how does Zen Buddhism approach that?
Well, I can tell you what my my teacher once told me when he didn't talk that I had two teachers, and one was a 91-year-old, and he's still 91. He was younger, but anyway, he was an elderly Japanese man, and he didn't talk too much about sex. The one thing I can remember him saying though was he felt that for a monk it was best to either be married or celibate, and in Japan a monk can be married because there's no rule of celibacy for monks, and that's a whole other topic. Right there, but that was how he felt the approach should be, and I can see how that makes the most sense. On the other hand, he told me this at a time when I just split up with my wife and I wasn't ready to take a vow of celibacy, so here I was getting this advice that I understood to be good advice and really not having the option of taking the advice, you know what I mean? I feel that for me and for a lot of people to take a vow of celibacy would just be a recipe for disaster, and we've all seen how disastrous that can be in some cases, especially for religious people. So the question becomes, okay, what do you do if you're not going to take the best options? And you know, if you happen to be constructed, Nina Hartley makes a really thoughtful case for polyamory in the book, and I'm not totally convinced, at least for my own life, but if that works, then okay. But you need to be honest with yourself.
I think that's the key.
Yeah.
And we're all different.
Yeah.
So we all have to be honest in different ways with
that's
ourselves.
Right.
And for some people, they're just too hot to be monogamous, and they need to do something about it. And they need to be honest about it.
Yeah.
And deal with it.
Well, honesty is the key. I mean, that's what the whole polyamory movement is kind of about, from what little I've read and talked to people about it. But it's the idea of finding a way, if you're too hot sexually, as you said, to be with just one partner. Well, how can you do that honestly? And that's kind of what Zen Buddhism is always on about, is trying to find a way to be 100% honest with yourself. That's why we do this Zazen practice, which is a kind of sitting practice, I don't even like to call it meditation, in which you are sort of constantly confronting yourself over and over and over as things come up moment by moment.
Being with yourself and letting that unwind.
Yeah, yeah. And seeing it and not flinching from what you see. That's the tough part. I mean, that's the part that's taken me 20-odd years of practice to get even a little bit comfortable with, is this attitude of whatever comes up, just accepting it. And accepting it doesn't necessarily mean being complacent about it and saying, oh, I can't change that, or that is what it is. You might have to change it once you see what it is. But what we tend to do is we have a self-image created by our ego that wants us to be a good person or whatever we imagine is a good person. And we have all kinds of stuff in our psyche that conflicts with that.
We're conditioned by our culture of organized religions, of all kinds of crazy people out there who might want us to behave the way they are.
Or the way they want to. I mean, that seems
true.
To be the thing with all the religious scandals. You know, it's always somebody who doesn't practice these things telling everybody else to, you know.
Right. Yeah. So it's really about understanding the way we are culturally conditioned, mm-hmm. and seeing ourselves with greater perspective.
And that's harder. That's a hard thing to do, because what Zen is kind of demanding is this almost universal perspective. This, or maybe lack of perspective is one way to put it, where you simply stop trying to even organize it in any way. Of course, your brain is set up to organize the information that it receives and produces into categories and to work it all out. And you don't want to stop that. But ultimately, you have to realize that all of your categorizations or all of your ideas are false to the degree that they are just ways of organizing reality, and they're not reality itself. And that's a really tough one to come to.
Well, when we realize we're all so different from each other, and we get into each other's heads, we find out we speak different languages.
Sure. That's a really a key thing, especially you mentioned different languages. That was one of the things of being in Japan and learning a new language. Really was very useful in finding out that there are completely different ways of organizing reality that you never would have thought of, and that's amazing.
But I think we need that if we're going to sit in zazen.
Yeah.
We don't want to be just sitting in our delusions.
Well, that's true, and how do you do that? You have to find a way to accept your delusions for what they are and recognize them and stay with them, but at the same time not get caught up.
But that's also knowing that they exist.
Yeah. Well, that's the first part, because a lot of people aren't even getting to that stage.
Right. Yeah. I mean, people already have preconceptions about Buddhism and Zen and there are so many stages of progress that to enter into and continue through, and you're a very advanced practitioner.
Oh, I don't know.
But you see, that's the point.
Yeah.
You're a very advanced practitioner. You've been doing it for 20 years. You teach it, and you're also in self-doubt.
Yeah.
But that's actually true for what the process is.
Yeah, well, that's, you're always self-doubt. That's, well, my first teacher had a line which I loved, which he would say that to understand Buddhism, you have to have an equal amount of doubt and faith, and you have to kind of balance those. So you always have a certain amount of doubt in there.
And that's going back to Buddha, the middle way.
Yeah. Yeah, of finding that way that's neither neither too rigorous nor too soft, and that isn't too doubtful or too faithful.
So actually, you know, in the book you talk about how Buddhism is not spiritual.
Yeah.
and really that's what we're talking about. It's not about cosmology and some god out there, and it's really about life and our minds and the way we have to work and live with our minds and our bodies. And certainly with this book on sex and Zen, it's really our bodies and their needs, and our minds and our feelings and their needs, and how to reconcile that in our life and do it appropriately.
Yeah. And the Buddhist view is that there isn't, we always separate body and mind, and the ultimate Buddhist viewpoint is that there isn't a real separation, that separation is artificial. Mind and body are the same thing.
They all speak the same language.
Yeah. And so, you know, your sexual needs are also partly spiritual. You know, you have all these aspects mixed together, and the divisions that we create are useful sometimes for understanding and intellectualizing what we're going through, but that ultimately when you probe into them, they fall apart.
And so what happens, you know, we are caught in this illusion that we're trying to fulfill ourselves and make things better and get to a place, perhaps even of a sense of completion, in full self-realization, and so there are all these ideas out there about this path that has some target, and that target in Zen Buddhism doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's also one of the hardest parts of Zen practice is that understanding. And people, you go to any decent Dharma talk, and they'll always keep telling you there's no point, and you go, well, what am I doing here? You know,
what's the point?
And somebody I was just listening to the other day said the real trick of it is the only way you will get the point of Zen Buddhism is to finally give up entirely the idea that there is any point to it. Because it's about living your life, and is there a point to this moment? You could say this moment is the culmination of something. You know, me being here, you being there, whatever, the people out there listening to this, it's the culmination of something. So that's the point.
But the problem most people have is that there is not enough.
Yeah.
And if you're living in the world of not enough, then your spirituality is not enough, your sexual happiness is not enough, everything is not enough.
Yeah.
We're not realized enough. You know, people come to me and they ask me, Peter, how self-realized do you think I am? I say, well, now that you asked, not as much as you think.
Yeah.
So we're really getting to, this understanding, and that's what I love about the book, is that it takes the point away mm-hmm. and gets into the process.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is actually values of self-values, how we hold our truths about ourselves in ways that are honorable.
Yeah, and that constantly seeking of something outside of what we are, or something better, or something more, that's the problem. And that'll always, until you get rid of that seeking something more, you're always going to have the problem, because there'll always be something more.
I think self-realization is to just realize this is it.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to go. Let's just do what we're doing and be, embrace it. The wholeness, the oneness is just within all of the chaos.
Yeah.
Is just appreciating the process.
Yeah, that's it. That's it, exactly.
And so that's why the practice of Zazen is a comforting practice, because it doesn't have a target. It's not that, you're sitting trying to become self-realized or reach some cosmological conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's that you're just in the, allowing yourself to be.
Yeah, and that's harder than it sounds.
But it can be a lot more fun if you include sex with it.
Sure. Well, that's part of the whole thing, because what are you doing when you're off the cushion and when you're on to the other cushions?
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I love about the book. It's Sex, Sin, and Zen, and it's a Buddhist exploration of sex, from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. And it's really fun to read, and you certainly every chapter has its deeper truths, and also it's exciting understandings about a subject matter that many of us are wanting to resolve more in our lives.
Yeah, and it's important to resolve these things, because they're big issues.
Well, this is, I think, a big book, and I know it's not your first, and so you really are chewing a lot of Zen Buddhism in the world and helping people chew it with you.
Well, I hope so. I never know what people are going to take out of it, and whenever I write a book, people are saying, "Well, you're being so helpful in doing this," and I think, well, yeah, that's nice. I just hope people laugh. There's some jokes in there.
Right. Well, but see, that's the point, and I think your personality, experiencing your personality, represents that.
Yeah.
You're not, trying to accomplish anything in particular. You're being, and being in that place where there's always some doubt and there's always unfinished business or whatever, and you live that, and that's your truth.
Yeah, and there always will be unfinished business. So
see, because we want our teachers out there to be totally having it all figured out. And I always say to people, as soon as you think you have life figured out, duck, because you're going to get slammed.
That's true. It's a dangerous position to be in to think you've got it all figured out.
So this is, it's so wonderful to see you living out your truths and being and yet accomplishing so much by providing the world with these understandings.
Thank you.
And so how can people reach you?
Well, I have a blog that's hardcorezen.blogspot.com, and I try to update that every maybe 3 days or so to make sure people know what's going on, and post articles there and things. And then there are links to the books.
And you're Brad Warner. So
that's
they could
right.
Google you.
Yeah, I think my blog is the first thing that comes up if you Google me. I'm Googleable.
Well, this has been so terrific to not only talk about this with you, but I think it's you're the clarity of it in person, and the book is so wonderful to enjoy. It's entertaining.
Thanks.
And enlightening. So thank you, Brad, so much for being on Energy Stew.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at Progressive Radio Network. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. And thank you so much for listening.